This is a CNA podcast.
Hi there, you're listening to Heart of the Matter. I'm Lin Su Ling. This week, we talk about the COVID-19 situation in light of new variants in Singapore and fresh restrictions slapped.
Both the Tan Tock Seng Hospital cluster and the ICA cluster, incidentally, are also variants associated with the Indian mutant. The new variant strains have higher attack rates, they are more infectious, they are causing larger clusters than before.
We're still not out of the woods as far as the Tan Tock Seng cluster is concerned.
That was co-chair of the Multi-Ministry Task Force Lawrence Wong and Director of Medical Services Dr. Kenneth Mark, speaking at a press conference on Monday to explain why Singapore needed tighter restrictions to stem COVID-19. Yet, what do the suite of measures mean in effect? Mr. Wong was pretty explicit.
Effectively, when you look at the range of measures, the measures will bring us back to phase two for a few weeks. This is not a circuit breaker.
With rising cases of infections in Singapore and mutated strains on the loose, can the restrictions give us reasonable confidence the risk can be sufficiently managed? Do the new variants suggest a sea change in how we fight this pandemic? How do our new contact tracing and testing capabilities stack up? And at the heart of it, is there a second wave on the horizon that suggests a new urgency to ramp up vaccination? It is Thursday, May 6, and with me to talk this through are Gavin Smith, Interim Director for Program in Emerging Infectious Disease at Duke NUS Medical School, and David Marcher, Professor at the Duke NUS Program in Health Services and Systems Research. So Gavin, start us off. There have been new variants of the coronavirus and they've brought a fresh raft of concerns in the global fight against the pandemic. Could you talk to us about the effects that these new variants have had on the situation in other countries and whether you've seen signs that they were responsible for fueling a new wave of infections?
It's important to understand that these genetic variants emerge from large-scale outbreaks. There's a number of genetic variants that are circulating global, and these are being detected in Singapore, both from travellers and community cases. And these have emerged from areas that have had large-scale outbreaks. They then spill over into other countries. So generally, these variants are more easily transmitted between people, but the evidence so far is that they're not necessarily more deadly. And the real concern is that these variants, as you mentioned, may be harder to control than the older strains of the virus. The question of whether or not these variants are fueling new outbreaks, it's kind of both. So they emerge from the outbreaks, they have increased transmissibility, and then that can contribute to the scale of the outbreak. But fundamentally, they emerge because there's a lot of infections, there's a lot of transmission, and that provides a lot of opportunities for the virus to mutate and for these variants to emerge.
Were there some worst-case scenarios you've seen around the world that could serve as cautionary tales for us in Singapore?
You mean in terms of large-scale outbreaks?
Yes, and the involvement of new variants.
Saying that there's involvement of variants in these large outbreaks is not really the point. These variants are generated in large-scale outbreaks. Mm. A variant is just a genetic mutant of the virus. Every single outbreak is caused by a variant of this virus because there's been continual evolution since the virus emerged in 2019. The outbreaks that we've seen in the United Kingdom, they've become dominant variants in those outbreaks. In the United States, there were dominant outbreaks there. From what we know at the moment, the main difference between these variants is the degree at which they're able to be transmitted between people. And there's also some evidence that they might affect the efficacy of the vaccines. But in general, the vaccines still work very well against these variants. So in terms of a worst case scenario, no. If you have large scale outbreaks that are not controlled effectively, then it's quite natural to see the emergence of virus variants.
Right. So it sounds like we have to keep the infections under control. David, you were going to weigh in before I interrupted.
I agree with Gavin. You're seeing outbreaks because people are susceptible, and that the virus is out there and it's circulating. It doesn't really matter what variant they get, they're getting infected. Where variants become important is in the medium and long term, which is to what extent we're playing a game, in effect, with this virus, and are we staying ahead of the virus, or are we always one step behind? And I think that's the question I'm very concerned about. It's a longer-term issue, which is you can deal with a particular surge, whether it's a variant or not, but in the long run, if the variant is able to bypass any of the measures that you have in place, whether it's because people are no longer protecting themselves with masks and social distancing and so on, or the vaccines are not as effective, that's where it becomes a problem.
Well, that's at the macro level, but let's zoom down into the micro individual level. Kevin, help us break it down. What happens if you catch a mutated strain? How different is it from catching a normal strain of the novel coronavirus?
So far, the evidence in terms of the infection, that they're very much the same. The evidence is that they're more transmissible, but not necessarily that they cause more severe disease. It would be, as far as we know, it would be the same. There, of course, is the possibility that there could be differences in the disease caused by variants, but we, at the moment, there's no evidence to support that.
But is there a difference between variants of interest versus variants of concern, which is the classification that the WHO is using to differentiate?
So the variants of interest and variants of concern is largely based on their prevalence and the known mutations that are known to affect receptor binding of the virus and things like that.
David, you were going to weigh in before I interrupted you again.
Oh, no, that's okay. The issue that really is key in these variants is the degree to which the virus is more infectious. And I think that the evolutionary pressure that for viruses to transmit better, then it does better. And so if we give the virus more and more opportunity, it's going to become better at transmitting. Gavin, you tell me if I'm not being, since I'm not an infectious disease person, really severity isn't in the best interest of the virus evolutionarily. I mean, if the virus starts to kill everybody, then it does a disservice to its offspring. So it's not going to transmit as easily. It's as severe as it needs to be in order to transmit. What's really important is whether it transmits more effectively.
It's very nuanced, right? If you look at the variants, we have different experimental information about the variants and the effect of these different mutations on the biology of the virus. So very recently, there was a preprint looking at one of these variants, and it showed that in an experimental system, that there was higher levels of the virus being produced late in infection. And that idea corresponds very well with the observation that the virus becomes more transmissible. But there's also evidence that shows that these variant viruses, it takes more antibodies to kill the virus than the older strains, which could be reflected in reduced efficacy for the vaccines. But the evidence that's coming out of the United States, and there's been another publication very recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, shows that the vaccines are still working and that they're effective against these different variants. So it's very much about the transmissibility of the virus and the opportunities that are given by having these large-scale outbreaks for the virus to continually evolve.
It's very interesting that we're having this conversation then, because there's been worries that as the pandemic proceeds, there might be more mutated strains, they might crisscross, and the impact would be even more severe. But what you're saying sounds like as the pandemic proceeds, what could happen is that there may be variants, they might be more transmissible, persistent even, but the symptoms might be less severe. And in effect, it could be endemic in the future, but not as life-threatening? Is that what you're getting at?
There's this idea that the virus attenuates in the human population the longer that it circulates in the population. And it's not necessarily that the virus is trying to avoid killing people because it affects transmission. A lot of it is that the more people that have been vaccinated, the more people that have been previously infected, they therefore will have an immune response that is going to protect them against a more severe disease. Over time, when vaccinated people are infected or previously infected people are reinfected, they don't get as sick and the disease becomes less severe in the population. And this is the basic idea behind vaccination. We want to reduce the severity of the disease.
And then I'm going to ask the naughty question, which is that we know now a lot more about the new variants and the effect vaccinations have on someone who has contracted a new variant as opposed to a quote-unquote normal strain of the novel coronavirus. But is there anything that tells us what could render a vaccine inert?
We know that there's neutralizing antibodies, and those are viruses that effectively stop the virus, render it inert. But the aim of vaccination is not necessarily to stop you from being infected. In an ideal world, yes. But the vaccines can also mean that when you are infected, even if you're vaccinated, that you don't get as sick. In terms of being infected with the variant or not with a variant, it doesn't really matter. There's current data from the United States Center for Disease Control, and they've looked at roughly 100 million people that have already been vaccinated. Of those, only one in every 10,000 were subsequently infected with SARS-CoV-2, which is a vanishingly small amount. And there was very, very little severe disease in that small portion of the people that became infected. These are people that would have been exposed to whatever variants were circulating in the United States.
There's still a lot that we don't know about the virus, however, that could really change the way we see it and the way we deal with it. There are two points that people often bring up: why reinfection happens and whether this has something to do with the new variant, as well as why do some people experience long COVID and could that change with the onset of these new variants? What do you think, Gavin?
In terms of why vaccinated people are infected or why there's reinfection, it could be for any number of reasons. People's immune response is not uniform. It could be that the people that are getting reinfected didn't have a very good immune response to vaccination. In terms of the variants, the evidence that we have at the moment is that the vaccination works just as well against the variants as it does against the earlier versions of the virus. In terms of long COVID, I think that's something that David is probably much better placed to answer than me.
Arrow to you, David.
Well, I mean, if the question is whether the variants are going to be more or less likely to induce these prolonged consequences, I don't know of any evidence to support that. From an evolutionary game perspective, it's not in the virus's best interest to necessarily mutate in a way that creates worse long-term consequences. It is an argument now for why we want to become careful over the long run and develop a long-term strategy for how to deal with COVID, which I think people are now starting to just come around to, thinking that, you know, this is really a chronic problem. This is something that we're going to have to deal with on an annual basis to reduce the onset of infection so that not only that people don't die and end up in the emergency room, into the hospital and so on, but that they also don't end up with these prolonged consequences. It's increasingly apparent that they're quite common. This is going to become a chronic problem. We're not going to solve this by vaccinating everybody in the world.
If I could follow up with what David is mentioning, a similar situation occurs with influenza where the vaccines need to be updated on a biannual basis. The World Health Organization, through a network of influenza collaborating centers, keep track of the evolution of the virus, how that is affecting the effectiveness of the vaccines. And then if they find that they're not as effective, then they change the components. And there's already some work being done around that in terms of updating some of the vaccines to include the spike genes from the new variants, because there's this concern that there could be a drop-off in the vaccine. And to David's point about it being a chronic problem, I think earlier you mentioned endemic. So the virus looks like it's going to be endemic in the human population. It looks like it's going to be an additional human coronavirus. So we'll have 5 instead of the current 4. That we need to have strategies for looking at how we deal with it, whether it be through a global system of updating vaccines or otherwise.
Speaking of strategies to deal with the COVID-19, the toolkit that countries, including Singapore, has been strengthened over the past year. There have been contact tracing enhanced by technology, a regime of regular testing for those in higher risk roles, and of course, safe distancing and mask wearing rules. But what's your opinion against the threat of these new variants and the situation today? Are we better off compared to a year ago, and why?
We're obviously, at least in Singapore, we're in a much better situation. I mean, Singapore has really put the pedal to the metal in terms of doing things like improving the ability to contact trace, really reducing the amount of time it takes to identify contacts. That has been really one of the saving graces for Singapore. It's one of the reasons why our rates are as low as they are, is that there has been such a good job contact tracing and sequestering people who have the virus. I mean, in addition to the fact that people have been fairly good about social distancing and mask wearing.
But are there areas for improvement when you look at what the best practices are around the world, given that we've seen a rise in community cases in the recent week?
Singapore is doing quite well, but could we do better? I think right now the places that people are recognizing that we have problems is that people are not doing as good a job, say, wearing their masks. You just have to wander down, some of the walkways where people are supposedly exercising, but not really very vigorously and not wearing their masks. A lot of people have gotten fairly, and I don't know what the numbers are, but they're getting looser about how they deal with mask wearing. And that's one of the things that is going to really help keep the numbers down.
Mm. So individual behavior have to step up, right?
And I think that people have gotten tired.
But just going back to rules, of course, travel restrictions have been top of mind because Singapore has a lot of visitors. And interestingly, the variants that first identified in the UK, India and South Africa have known to have longer gestation periods. So the government has increased the number of days in quarantine to 21. Gavin, weigh in here. Are you reasonably confident that 21 days is a good amount of time? And why this 3-week window?
Other countries have introduced the longer period. They've had a 3-week quarantine period, I think, in Hong Kong for quite some time, with a longer gestation time that it should be effective. But it's not a standalone measure. It's the whole suite of different measures that are important. In terms of doing better and something that we could do better with, the level of vaccination, there's a lot of hesitancy out there. The vaccines work. If we have a higher proportion of people that are vaccinated, if there's any breakthrough from the quarantine, then there would be less concern because, again, to sound like a broken record, but the vaccines are effective in protecting people, at least from severe disease. There's evidence that they also reduce transmission because there's not as much virus being produced in an infected individual. And that is something that longer term is going to help. The earlier points of how long the vaccines might be effective against these different variants, at the moment, it doesn't matter. We've got to deal with the current situation now.
So just one more question before I also ask David to weigh in. If indeed a longer quarantine period is better, wouldn't it be safer to, number one, extend this 21 days to all arrivals across the board when these variants have spread across the world and we've seen some crisscrossing? And number two, how safe then is 21 days when we've seen cases that test negative after quarantine and then positive when they head out?
In terms of applying this to every single country, would it be necessary for somewhere from New Zealand? I mean, yes, you could do so. But having a more nuanced approach is probably appropriate. There's other things that we could be looking at. We could be looking at the vaccination status of individuals before they travel. There's been talk about vaccine passports. It's important to look at a range of different things. When we're talking about travel, it's often going to be in collaboration with the other countries. So it's difficult. Do we really want to see Singapore completely cut off from the rest of the world? These need to be managed.
I agree that 21 days makes sense. I mean, we've known that the virus can take up to 21 days or maybe even a bit longer for it to become symptomatic. A lot of the cases recently, it's been apparent that they became positive after 14 days. So 21 days made sense in the context of the current situation, which is a more nuanced approach. The question is really how much can the country stand economically? I mean, again, we're going to have cases. What we want is we want to have as few cases as possible. We want as few deaths as possible, and we don't want to overwhelm the hospital system. The question is, if we went over 21 days, what's the extra benefit we get? And I think that it would be a very small benefit.
Last question in this area of travel restrictions, just to really press the point. The thing is, there still is talk online about shutting off borders to travellers to prevent transmission into Singapore, since that's where risks come from after close to zero community cases for so long. We can talk about the feasibility, and we've talked about the desirability of that. The devil's advocate is, given the global situation, if we were to shut off travel, how long would we have to do this for?
Hypothetically, if we were to shut off Singapore, you'd have to probably go through a few cycles of these, you know, small waves. But eventually, if you've literally closed off the border in a couple of months, I don't know, Gavin, what do you think?
I think something like that. But the problem is, what happens when you open up again? There's going to be outbreaks elsewhere. So yes, we could completely shut off Singapore for however long and be secure that there's no community transmission. But as soon as you open up again, there's always going to be a risk because there will be outbreaks elsewhere in the world. The best tool that we have at the moment is vaccination. In the initial outbreaks, we had no vaccines. Now we have the vaccines. It's been shown that they're safe and effective in the countries that have got high levels of vaccination, or the areas of countries that have got high levels of vaccination. The number of cases and transmission falls. We need to look at the complete suite of control measures, quarantines, not necessarily border closures on our ends, but blocking flights from countries that currently have large outbreaks and that are therefore at a higher risk of importation, etc., and things like that. But I just don't see it as being realistic that really any country can completely shut its borders for 1 month, 2 months, 6 months. As soon as you open up, there's going to be more cases.
But Gavin, even with vaccination, right, we expect that restrictions will still be slapped on and there might be controls that will still be needed in order to control any infections that come in. Don't you think that even with vaccinations, we will see this sort of shifting goalposts with changing rules to suit the risk assessment as the new normal?
Yeah, but what is the risk assessment when we have the population vaccinated?
One of the things that's sort of a subtext to all of this is that we're not vaccinated. As a population, we're not vaccinated. As our adjacent countries are not vaccinated. I mean, I'm personally vaccinated, and I suppose, Gavin, you may be vaccinated, but as a country, Singapore doesn't have a super high vaccination rate. The older population has a pretty good rate. Certainly, our adjacent countries have a lousy rate, and, you know, the number of cases are exploding. And all the countries that have historically had a lot of flights and a lot of in-migration have very high rates. So we haven't done a great job with vaccinations. And we pat ourselves on the back a lot, but we haven't done a great job with vaccinations.
Hey, but David, what makes you say that though? Because we've seen already 1.3 million people take at least one dose and 850,000 people vaccinated. How does this compare with vaccination rates around the world?
Oh, no, it's better. It's certainly better, but we're not definitely at the top of the heap. If you look at other countries, rates of vaccination are somewhere in the middle zone of developed countries. I mean, we're definitely not at the top, and I think we could do better. But I'm not complaining that we've got a lousy system. I think everything has been very systematic and is going well, but we definitely do need to get vaccination rates up, and we have to deal with the issue of vaccination hesitancy. But also we have to deal with the fact that the countries that we live near and people who will travel to Singapore are not going to be very well vaccinated. And we have to worry about Malaysia. We have to worry about Thailand and so on, which hardly have much of the population vaccinated.
I'm just trying to get both your take to really nail this down. I'm hearing a lot about this urge for vaccination against the backdrop of all we've talked about, you know, rising cases of mutated strains around the world. Are you saying that there's fresh urgency to ramp up vaccination because of the global situation? Or if not, what else?
There's always been an urgency with vaccination. There's quite a lot of vaccine hesitancy in Singapore. As I understand it, some of that is due to there's misinformation online and also in news headlines sometimes. Every single case where there's some sort of adverse reaction is front page news. But when you actually dig into the numbers, it's incredibly small. And the vaccines, the information that we have to now is that they're very safe and they work. In countries where there hasn't been large outbreaks, there's a bit of complacency because people are going, okay, I'll adopt a wait and see attitude. There's no real reason for me to get the vaccine at the moment because there's so little risk of being infected in the community. In countries where you've got large outbreaks, people want to get the vaccine. They see it as, quite rightly, as the best way of protecting themselves when you've got these large outbreaks. there's always been a priority to get people vaccinated, but on an individual level, there's many different reasons why people do and don't see it as a priority. In terms of opening up a country, having all the existing control measures, yes, we'll probably still need to keep them, at least for a shorter term. To go back to an earlier question of yours, having a higher proportion of the population vaccinated, it changes the risk profile of an introduction into the community. It would mean that you have a lesser chance of a large outbreak from an introduced case.
David, I just want to ask one last question to round off this podcast to you. The restrictions that have been slapped on Monday have been characterised as a return to phase two. And if you recall, that's when Singapore announced an easing of restrictions last year in June. At that point, there was about 8 cases in the community, which is roughly comparable to where we are. But is this return to phase two, this comparison, accurate in light of all we've discussed today?
Well, I think that we're in a very different situation than we were then. The idea of calling it phase two, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's a higher level of alertness, the level of awareness of the population, for the population, that something is amiss. Exactly whether it's the right mix or whatever is another question. But I think the message has been sent appropriately that right now is not the time to lower our guard. This is not the time to lower our guard. So whatever the specific mix and whatever the name is for the for what status we're in, it's an appropriate message to send. We need the population to be more alert to getting vaccinated and maintaining social distancing. We are still quite vulnerable.
David, Gavin, thank you so much for today. And there you have it on how Singapore's restrictions and slew of measures stack up in the face of new contagious variants and the global situation on the pandemic. This has been Heart of the Matter, brought to you by Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. I'm Lin Su Ling, signing off until next time.